CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang is with me, and we turn to Taiwan under threat, repeated threat by the People's Republic of China. The Vice Admiral of the 7th Fleet, speaking in Singapore to an official audience, made this remark. It's very important that we contest this type of thing. I know that the gorilla in the room is launching missiles over Taiwan. If we just allow that to happen, said Vice Admiral Carl Lewis of the 7th Fleet, and we don't contest that, that'll be the next norm. It's irresponsible to launch missiles over Taiwan into international waters where the shipping lanes, where free shipping operates. We welcome Stephen Yates, chair of the America First Policy Institute's New China Policy Initiative. Steve, it is heartening to hear the 7th Fleet Vice Admiral Deputy speak candidly and correctly about the Chinese provocation. Then again, there were voices in the U.S. Navy who spoke out over the South China Sea islands, now fortified with runways and anti-air. So at this point, do we need more than Navy to speak out? Good evening to you, Steve.
Well, thank you, John. For sure, he speaks the truth with regard to how outrageously provocative the missile tests were and the ongoing military, economic, and other forms of coercion as these things haven't really abated. There are temporary pauses. They continue around Taiwan, but also in the South China Sea. And you are absolutely correct that this is not a recent phenomenon with regard to the South China Sea. There's almost been a straight line upward trajectory of China's development and encroachment upon territorial claims in the South China Sea. And contrary to Xi Jinping's direct promise to the U.S. president, they are in fact militarized. So it's quite correct that if there isn't some kind of a rallying pushback among allies and partners in the region, this does in fact become the new norm. What is unacceptable does in fact become acceptable.
And Gordon, to your understanding, because the provocations associated with the Speaker of the House's visit continued with more warplanes and misconduct following or a coterminous with the visit of other delegations from the Congress. And I understand the Canadian officials are now planning a visit. So these provocations, Gordon, did they come to anything? Did they benefit Xi Jinping or the Communist Party?
Internally, they may have benefited Xi Jinping. We really don't know. They just finished up their 2 weeks at Beidaiha, their annual seaside resort retreat. Xi Jinping is now traveling around China, and they're now starting to report on his activities, which means that very important conclave has concluded. We don't know what went on there, John, and we probably won't know for a very long time, if ever. But clearly around the world, it showed a side of China that people abhor. So I don't think it actually helped Beijing, at least externally.
You have a question for our friend Steve.
Steve, the response of the Biden, you talked about pushback, as a lot of people have. The Biden administration seems to have a very weak response to these provocations. In fact, it looked like it was trying to undermine Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taipei. Why do you think that is? And do you think the Biden administration will actually start a more robust response in view of these continued Chinese provocations?
Well, I would like to believe that they would see what Beijing's actions have been. The fact that Xi Jinping had promised Barack Obama when Joe Biden was vice president that China would not, in fact, militarize islands in the South China Sea. The efforts made by the Biden administration to put a more positive tone in the U.S.-China relationship after the Trump years. And all of these things basically have been swatted back into their faces by China's wolf warrior diplomacy and other actions. You would think the natural response by the White House would be to recalibrate their efforts and maybe take a tougher line towards China. In rhetoric, at times, they appear to do that, but there's no measurable way that they're doing that, but for occasional messages by the military, maybe transits and deployments into the vicinity, as they did in the time of Speaker Pelosi's visit and those more robust missile tests. But otherwise, it has been a rather tepid response. And there's been no indication of a significant price to be paid by China in terms of pulling back on economic engagement, decoupling, recalibration our investments, anything along those lines.
Gordon, the divisions between people in government do not consist entirely in Washington. There's also a division in government in Taipei, Taiwan. What is the KMT, Gordon, and what are your concerns?
KMT is the initials for the Kuomintang, which was formerly the ruling party. This was Chiang Kai-shek's party that ruled China prior to 1949 and then fled to Taiwan and set up a military, basically dictatorship, which eventually evolved into a democracy. In that democracy, you now have the Democratic Progressive Party governing Taiwan with Tsai Ing-wen, and the KMT is in opposition. And the reason why this has become highlighted recently is because the KMT vice chairman, Andrew Hsia, left for China on a delegation, which is a previously announced trip. But the point was, it occurred during the extreme provocations of China that followed Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taipei. And many people think that the KMT delegation to China was inappropriate, especially at this time.
Steve, I enjoy telling an anecdote that Gore Vidal left with me many years ago. He said, John, never call it a conspiracy when the word coincidence will do. Do we believe the visit of the KMT leadership to mainland at this time was a coincidence of the provocations of missiles fired over Taiwan?
I think in terms of timing, it was coincidence, but everyone has a choice about whether or when they're going to take their pre-planned trip. It's very, very doubtful that there was much by way of harvest available for the KMT to go to China in any respect. The touted mission was to meet with Taiwanese businesses and students that are in China, as the KMT was acting as if a sort of shadow government to care for the well-being of Taiwan compatriots existing within the communist system over there. But while the communist system is launching missiles in the direction of Taiwan and threatening the ongoing economic activity of Taiwan itself, I think that there was every reason to question the timing of this, especially. And that fissure is not just between the KMT and the DPP in Taiwan. That fissure is between older generations and younger generations. There were younger generation Nationalist Party or Kuomintang members in Taiwan that were vocally challenging the timing and efficacy of this trip at that moment. And so this legacy Nationalist Party that did, as Gordon accurately conveyed, 100 years of history in just a minute. The only thing I would add to that is it was Chiang Kai-shek's party, but then for a time it was Lee Teng-hui's party, where he tried to make it the Taiwan Kuomintang as opposed to the Chinese Kuomintang. And it was his successors, Ma Ying-jeou especially, that went back to the China Kuomintang. And that stamp is sort of the historical legacy of Chiang Kai-shek, but it's very out of step with mainstream Taiwan, including the younger generation of the KMT. So I think this was a bad signal, strategically horrible, but also a loser inside Taiwan.
Gordon, you have a question for Steve.
Steve, just to talk about that important trend you talked, which is the Taiwanization of Taiwan politics. It is, of course, in the Democratic Progressive Party, which is Taiwanese-based. But also, as you point out, the opposition KMT understands that in order to survive as a political organization, it has to go with the flow. In other words, it has to identify with Taiwan and not with China. There's going to be a presidential election in 2024 on the island. How is the KMT faring in general in the run-up to that?
Well, this recent episode is not very helpful to them, although it was a bit of a mix inside Taiwan. One of the items that the Chinese side seemed to want to put on the agenda for this KMT delegation was for the KMT to explain itself with regard to its recent closeness with the United States. And so KMT did have to be careful, especially during that time of heightened tensions and crisis, at least in the international media coverage of Taiwan. There is a growing sense within the KMT that the only winning way, but also self-preservation path available to them was to lean more towards the United States, as opposed to the policy that they advocated during President Ma Ying-jeou's tenure of kind of keeping the United States close, but leaning more towards China for economic development, if not more. And so I think that they have kind of a foot on both shores as this waterway expands beneath them.
And Steve, right now, would you say that Tsai Ing-wen, her party, benefits from these odd behavior of KMT after the missile firings? Is this a plus for her, for the president?
It is. In many ways, the Democratic Progressive Party, of course, Tsai Ing-wen will be term limited. She will not run in 2024, so there'll be competition for who might succeed her. But the Democratic Progressive Party is given a fairly easy path forward because it is explicitly identified with Taiwan identity. So it's the Nationalist Party that faces this unique challenge of trying to hold forward the fantasy of there being one China when the Taiwan people increasingly, especially those who have never known anything else, see only a Taiwan identity. And anyone, no matter what ethnicity they are, if they threaten that future for them, is their opponent, not a potential partner, and certainly not a party to unify with.
Steve Yates, chair of the America First Policy Institute's New China Policy Initiative, Gordon Chang. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.